Okay. So, I'll just continue where I stopped before this morning here, and continue with the same sutta, the same discourse by the Buddha, and then we'll see how far we get in this particular thing here. So, just to recapitulate very quickly what the purpose of this. The purpose of this is to learn how to deal with the mind, how to kind of move the mind, shift the mind from move away from the unwholesome aspects of the mind and move towards the wholesome aspects of the mind instead. So far we looked at how to deal with the unwholesome, and now the sutra in a sense repeats itself. It says the same thing about the wholesome side as well. This is often how the sutras are structured. They give you kind of a very exhaustive view of things. They give you the unwholesome, the bad side, or the good side. This is how often they work. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this, and then I'll comment as usual as we go through this. And he says here, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus that this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and it leads to nirvana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night or day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi, far from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and constant, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So here we have the opposite of what we had before. The Buddha, again, he starts off by realizing the opposite of sense desire. The opposite of sense desire is a thought of no desire, if you like, or renunciation. When we talk about renunciation in Buddhism, essentially it means a renouncing of the sensuality. That's the main meaning of the idea of renunciation. So he thinks a thought that leads away from sense desire, right? A thought which, as I said before, understands the dangers, understands the problem, and goes in a different direction. Maybe a thought to do with metta or something like that. And then he understands that there is no problem with this kind of thought. This does not cause any problems between people. If you have a thought where you abandon things, you give up things, you don't have attachment to things, then there is no conflict with others. It doesn't cause any problems for yourself in the future, because there's nothing that you is going to be taken away from you, so to speak. You don't attach, you let things go instead. That's what this means. But the interesting point here, what comes from this, is that he says here, there's no danger in this kind of thinking. But even if there is no danger, there still is the problem that you get tired from this kind of thinking. It says here, you get tired in the body. It's a little bit strange, because usually you would say you get tired in the mind when you think too much. But it's, sometimes you want to go to sleep, right? You get physically tired if you have a very tiring job. If you have to use your brain excessively, think a lot, you also get a physical tiredness as well. So there is a connection between the two. In any case, the point is that you get tired from this. And because thinking in any way tires you out, you actually need to go even deeper into the meditation practice. And this is very similar to what I was saying yesterday. I was talking about the sutta, which was the simile of the goldsmith. And it says at the end there, it says that even the thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, remember that I changed the translation a little bit, I said the thoughts that accord with the Dhamma. And of course these are thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, right? You renounce, you have metta, you have compassion. But even those thoughts are a problem, because eventually that too will actually tire you out. So what you have to do then is you have to abandon those thoughts as well, right? You don't even think those things. So you let those go. But based on those thoughts, you use them as the foundation for entering a state of samadhi. And that's what he does here. because you have a positive view of the world, you have a positive mind, you have a positive feeling about things, your perception is positive, everything is very good, it's relatively easy to enter a state of deep samadhi. And that is what happens next. He gives up even those thoughts, right? So again, you can see the gradual training. You give up the bad, then you give up even the good, and then you go to something even better here. And then this expression here, which is not very obvious probably, is that it says here that so I steadied my mind internally. In other words, internally, you're not affected by the senses anymore, right? Is what it means internally, inside of yourself. You quieten it down, you bring it to singleness, this idea of one-pointedness of the mind, a single object, no movement of the mind, and you still it. And this here is basically another word, another way of expressing this idea of samadhi in the suttas. One of the things that you find in the suttas, the Buddha always likes to use synonyms. He expresses the same idea in different ways. And the reason for that is because when you see one idea expressed from different angles, you come to understand the idea much better. If you always use the word samadhi and it didn't explain it from different angles, you wouldn't have a very clear idea what it's about. But because it is expressed and shown in many different ways, after a while you start to get a very broad, quite a full understanding of what this idea of samadhi is about. And that's why you have all these synonyms in the sutras. That's one reason. There are other reasons as well. And the samadhi that we're talking about here is essentially the jhana. That's essentially what we're talking about. That's basically what the samadhi means. So you do that so that the mind should not be restrained. And this idea of samadhi, the idea is that you rest the mind 100%. The deeper your meditation is, the more rested you feel when you come out afterwards. I'm sure you have noticed that. The purpose of one of the nice reasons why we meditate is because it actually is a very beautiful rest. You feel much more energized afterwards. Energy comes back into the mind, right? You feel more able to function in the world because you have more energy. But to have real rest, the deeper you go, the more powerful the rest. And the most powerful of all rest is when you go into a deep state of samadhi. And people say, people who attain these kind of states, when they are really profound, I'm talking about the real jhanas, right? Not kind of the some people, there's a disagreement about what the jhanas mean, but when the more profound these things are, the more energy you have. People say it's like you come out, you feel like a nuclear reactor afterwards. That's how much energy you have, you feel like, but it's not the kind of, often in life, when we talk about energy, we think about being restless or agitated and these kind of things. But this is not that sort of energy. It's just energy which is still, right? It's completely peaceful, but incredible powerful energy. So it's a kind of, it's different from what we often think of as energy in ordinary life. It's peaceful energy. This is what happens here. So I'll go through this fairly quickly because time is getting a bit shorter. So, and then it is the same thing with the thoughts of non-ill will. This can be understood as metta. Metta is opposite of ill will. It's probably a bit more than that, but that's one way of looking at it. Non-cruelty, this is like not being ruthless, right? So the opposite of ruthlessness, which basically is compassion. So thoughts of compassion. And then he understands, first of all, he understands that this thought is present, right? This is the first thing here. So you, and then he again understands that these things are not dangerous. These things do not cause any problems in the world. And we know that when you have compassion and metta, it doesn't lead to conflict with other people. There might still be conflict because of how other people react with you. But it's from your side, there's never any conflict when you have real metta and compassion. So it doesn't lead to affliction for myself or others. It doesn't cause difficulties. It aids wisdom, right? All of these things aid wisdom. These are the supports for wisdom practice, and it moves towards nirvana. But then again, because it strains the mind to think about these things, you abandon them and you go into a state of samadhi. And then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind, or a bhikkhu or anybody else for that matter. And if he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire and cultivates the thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will or metta, thoughts of compassion, he has abandoned the thought of ill will, and he has abandoned the thought of being ruthless to cultivate the thought of compassion, and then his mind inclines towards compassion and metta. Again, this idea that these things become easy after a while, right? Because your mind inclines in that way. It becomes, when you practice compassion a lot and kindness a lot, it becomes relatively easy to be kind and compassionate. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that the stakes were there. So the more pure your mind, the easier it is, the less activity you have to do, the less wisdom even you have to use to curb the mind this way and that way. Just like the cowherder, he just sits at the root of a tree, kind of watches the cows, but doesn't actually do anything anymore. So life becomes easier, which is always nice when things become easier. Can't hurt. And then he says at the end, he says, then when he does this, then tireless energy was aroused in me. Unremitting mindfulness, it means like steady mindfulness, right? Mindfulness which doesn't slack, was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind was stilled and unified. So this is what happens when you practice in this way. The energy is aroused, right? The things that sap the energy in us are the defilements. When you have defilements, when you have desires, they tend to sap the energy. Mindfulness is established. Mindfulness gets established when the defilements decrease. This is how we get mindful. That's actually a very important point, isn't it? Often we think that we're going to be mindful of the defilements. But in fact, the more defilements you have, the more difficult it is to be mindful. So a decrease in the defilements leads to more mindfulness. Why is that? It's good to think about these things. Why is that the case, that there is more mindfulness when there's less defilements? Well, first of all, what is mindfulness? Mindfulness is the ability to stay in the present moment, right? To be here and now, to be able to observe what is happening here. That is what mindfulness is about, to be in the present moment. Now, if you have desires, what are desires all about? Desires are about something you want, so they are about the future. So a desire by its very nature drives you out of the present moment. So if you have desires, if you're thinking about, you know, or something, a perception or a thought about something you want or crave for, by its very nature, it's not in the present moment. The mind tends to be not right here, right now. And the same thing with anger. Anger is often connected with the past. You're thinking about something that somebody has done, or thinking about something that, you know, wasn't right or whatever. And so ill will or negativity is often about the past. So again, the mind is the exact opposite of being in the present moment. So defilements of the mind tends to drive you out of the present moment. It's basically impossible to be totally mindful while there still are defilements in the mind. So by reducing the defilement, that's what it's saying here, the mindfulness becomes really powerful and really established. And the real practice of Satipatthana practice, can really only happen when the defilements are on a very low, at a very low level. There's still maybe a little bit left, but not much left. Otherwise, Satipatthana is basically impossible. It requires Satipatthana, the use of sati, of mindfulness, requires a very low level of defilements. It's important to remember that. Sometimes we tend to water out the teachings of the Buddha so much that the actual real power of these teachings become lost on the way. The last one here is, the body is tranquil and untroubled, right? To feel peaceful. And the mind is still. The stillness of the mind comes again from the mindfulness. Mindfulness comes first. And then the stillness, the samadhi, arises out of that mindfulness. There's a clear cause and effect sequence here. Okay, so let us move on to the next sutta. So this sutta is about called the removing of resentment. So resentment is basically just another word for anger or ill will, if you like. And the idea with this particular sutta is, as I said before, the most important thing to overcome in our lives, whether you are a monastic or a layperson or whatever, anger is by far the most destructive of the defilements, destructive both for your own practice and also destructive for, you know, for our interaction with other people and for our happiness and for everything. It's a very destructive kind of emotion. So if you are going to work on anything in the mind, if you're going to work about any defilement, the defilement that is most important to deal with, first of all, is always anger. Work on anger. Even if you're not a very angry type of character, you can still reduce whatever is left, right? We all feel irritated every now and again. There's always little things there which aren't quite right. So even if you're not an angry type of person, still, you can use this to even reduce it even further. The more you reduce these things, the more powerful your meditation is going to become. So this is why I've chosen it. And this is a very practical, what we have looked at so far may perhaps seem a little bit kind of idealistic and theoretical. This is a very practical way of how to deal with these things. That's why I want to have a look at this. So this sutta is taught by Venerable Sariputta. Sariputta was the right-hand man of the Buddha. He was the one who was said to have a wisdom virtually equivalent to the Buddha himself. And for that, so there's many suttas or discourses by him to be found as well. So this is how it goes. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing anger or resentment by which anyone should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. It means like peace of mind, basically. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. This is the summary of the sutta. And then comes the exposition afterwards. So the idea here with these five categories is that we deal with people a little bit differently depending on what kind of person they are. And I'll explain this as we move along, as we go through the sutta. But the point here is that this is all-encompassing. All kinds of people are included here, so that there is nobody anywhere whom you cannot remove the anger you might have towards that person. So everybody is included, right? And these methods, as it says here, they are there to entirely remove resentment. So this method, when applied fully and completely, will completely take away any anger you might have. So everybody's included, right? That's good news. So that we can actually... So there's nobody kind of left out. You have to be angry towards it. So that's always nice. Okay. So, now let's have a look at the details of this sutta. So let's have a look at each one of these in turn. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu, a monk, sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. On that occasion, he should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right? Quite straightforward, right? It seems quite straightforward. The purpose of this is to show you that basically people have many qualities. People have some good qualities, some bad qualities. It's very rare to find somebody who's just bad or just good. People often have a mixture of things. And it is how we attend to that person that decides whether we will have anger or whether we will have metta and compassion, understanding, whatever it is. It's how we attend that matters. It is easy to fall into the trap and to think that people have like permanent qualities. This person is like this, right? This person has this bad quality, and I see it for sure. And then you think that, to be honest, then you have to actually see that bad quality. If you don't see it, you're being dishonest or whatever. This is often how people think, and it's very easy to think that way. But remember, there's many, many things here about any perceived bad qualities in other people. First of all, it's very hard to really know whether they have that bad quality. What you see, you might be deluded, right? You might yourself not really understand what's going on. You may see something which happened in a very special situation. This may not be how they ordinarily are as a person. So it's very difficult to judge other people. It's very hard to really understand their character. So this is the first thing, when you look at somebody else, is to remember to give people the benefit of the doubt. Because so often we just don't know what other people are like. We don't know where they're coming from, what is actually happening with them. So if you see something bad, it's better to shrug your shoulders and not to worry about too much about it. By understanding that these qualities, secondly, are not permanent. I see that in my own life. You can see how kind of you go through periods, and sometimes you go through a period when you know things are quite difficult, and maybe you have many kind of more darker qualities in your mind, and then you come back to another period when things are going better for you. The things aren't an essence in you. This is who you are. These are always changing things inside of you. So there's nothing really. We don't have to focus on the negative. We don't have to. There's no honesty with saying, I must see the bad in other people. It's actually just another sort of delusion instead. And once you get that out of the way, this idea that you have to, to see both the good and the bad, then you can actually train yourself just to see the good instead. Focus on the good qualities. Build those up inside of you. If there is somebody in your life who you find difficult, somebody who you find it's just too easy to see the bad qualities in that person, then you can train yourself to see the good factors, the good aspects instead. Right? It's just a matter of training. Because there isn't really any truth, there is no truth to say that these are the bad qualities, are the good qualities, because there is no absolute truth there, you can shift your mind as much as you want until all you see, all that is left, is seeing the good aspects of that person. And this is what this is about. And you may think it's hard, and it is, it's not that it's hard, it's just that it takes perseverance, it takes putting in the effort, actually wanting to do this. And if you persevere, if you put in the effort, it's something anyone can do. You don't have to be intelligent, you don't have to be, anything in particular, it's just that you have to persevere. It's the perseverance which is hard, actually having the ability to persevere, that is the difficult part, but the actual thing itself is not hard to do. So this is what this is about. So the beautiful simile here about the rag-robed bhikkhu, right? So the bhikkhus, they would have robes a little bit like these ones here. Actually, a little bit different from this. At the time in India, they would have it. It would actually be much shorter than this. Probably maybe only going up to here or something. But you have another one underneath, right? So it's okay. Otherwise, it might be a bit dodgy. The monks and nuns, of course, will also have robes, a little bit different, but a similar kind of idea. And often they would have rag robes. So what they would do, they would collect the rags. They would find, it's quite interesting, they would find cloth, that was left in the on the wayside or somewhere on the side of the road. Or they would go to the charnel grounds. A charnel ground is a place where you burn the corpse, right? So you have a person, he gets chucked on the charnel ground, and he he's dead presumably, so you're chucked on the charnel ground there. And then you lie, this corpse will lie on the charnel ground for a few days, right? And will sit there and rot and stink, whatever, before it gets burnt. And then the monk or the nun, they would come and they would see this corpse and think, great, you know, some cloth here on this corpse. And this is how it works. And then they would take the cloth off the corpse and then use it. And of course, they would take off all the stuff that wasn't usable, that was rotten or smelly or whatever, and use the good part and sew robes with that. There's a great story in the vineyard. The Vinaya Pitaka has all the rules of the monastics. And there's a story of a monk who does just that. He goes to the charnel ground and he finds a corpse. But this corpse has just been thrown on the charnel ground. It's still warm, right? So the spirit is still in the corpse. You know, the mind is still there. It hasn't fully left it yet. So the monk starts to take the cloth from the corpse. And then the corpse starts to speak to him. And the corpse says, "Monk, are you taking the cloth off my body here? You can't do that." And the monk doesn't pay any heed. He takes the cloth off. And he starts walking back to his kuti here. And when he walks back to his kuti, the corpse rises up. He starts walking after him. And then eventually quickly goes into his kuti. And then the corpse falls down on the outside. So that's you can see it's good fun to be a Buddhist monk when you can read these kind of stories. So this is a story. I don't know if it actually happened or not, but that's one of the stories in the monastic discipline here. So anyway, the reality is that they used to do that, and they used to take cloth whenever they could find it, whether it was on the charnel ground or by the roadside or something that was given to them, maybe a piece of cloth here and there. And I actually had a robe like that myself when I was a young monk. It was very completely patchwork all over her, and it was quite—it's quite nice in a sense to have a patchwork robe, you know. It's quite—I don't know. I enjoyed it. I think now it's too much hassle to do all the sewing, but I enjoyed it at that time anyway. So those are the rag robe monks. Just a little bit of fun and games there, and so when you then find a cloth on the road, you spread it out, and then you tear off, as it says here, you tear off those sections that you cannot use, and the section which is intact, you take that with you, right? So what do you do? The sections which are no good, you tear them off, and you throw them out, right? And it's just like that, because they're rubbish. They are useless, something you can't use. And it's exactly the same thing when you look at another person. The bad things that you see, it's rubbish, it's garbage. You don't want to carry that with you. You tear it off the person, you throw it out, and you keep the parts which are beautiful and nice. Right? Remember that. The negative things you see are rubbish. You don't want to carry rubbish around you in your mind. It just defiles you, it distorts yourself, and it destroys your own life. There's a beautiful, beautiful idea here that all the negative stuff is rubbish. Throw it out, don't take it with you. So there it is. But again, remember that these things, they take training, right? All of the things on the Buddhist path are about training yourself. It takes time to be able to do these kind of things. So you have to try again and again. And as you try again and again, you learn about yourself, you learn about the other person, and after a while you start to see how it works, and it becomes possible to do these things. Okay. So that is the first one. So that is the person whose speech is good, but whose verbal bodily behavior is bad, right? And I understand this to mean, it could be a distinction between speech and bodily behavior, but I understand this to be just a way of saying that we have different qualities in different areas, so you focus on the area where the good qualities are. That's how I understand this. But you can also understand it more literally, probably. Okay, number two. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants, and a man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink with his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure and his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of the verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is very similar to the previous one. The only difference really is that the simile here is a bit different. That's really the only thing. I like this simile here. It's quite a nice one. The simile here is the pond with algae and water plants, right? The pond is the water. The algae and the water plants are like the bad qualities, and the clear water are like the good qualities in the person. So a person arrives who is afflicted and oppressed by the heat. This is the angry person, right? When you are angry, you are afflicted and oppressed. The anger oppresses you. You feel angry. You can't get rid of the anger. You don't know what to do. And this is what you do then afterwards. So this is an oppression and an affliction. And you are weary. You're thirsty. Thirsty is like you're trying to find a solution to this, right? You're parched. You're hot. This idea of fire. You are on fire when you are angry. And then what do you do? Well, you plunge into the pond, right? You sweep aside the algae and the water plants. You sweep away the negative things. And you plunge into the good qualities of the pond here. You plunge into that. And that, of course, cools you down. So the good qualities are just like the cool water of the pond. They cool you down and make you feel at ease and relaxed again. It's a nice idea, isn't it? It's kind of this idea of the good qualities in a person being like the cool waters of a pond. So, and then you drink from that, you immerse yourself completely. Drinking is like imbibing these things. You draw it into yourself, and when you draw it into yourself, then you that oppression, that heat, whatever it is, it leaves you as a consequence. So in the same way, you focus on the good qualities of somebody else, and when you focus on the good qualities, this is what happens. And now comes the person who doesn't have so many good qualities. That's the next one, number three. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity or calm of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours and suck it up like a cow and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of the body and the and speech, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the calm of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here is someone who is a little bit of a bad fellow, who does bad things, but still he has some part of his mind, there's still some mental aspects of this person that are good. And these mental aspects here are things that are here called the opening of the mind. And this word opening of the mind is the opposite in Pali of the hindrances. This is called here the vivarana. Vivarana is opposite of nivarana. Nivarana means hindrance in Pali. Vivarana is an opening of the mind. It's the opposite of the hindrances. So when the hindrances go away, it's like your mind, in a sense, opens up. That's what this means. And of course, when the hindrances go away, at least to some extent, maybe not fully, but to a large extent, then your mind becomes calm as well, right? As I was saying before, it is the hindrances that keep you restless and oppressed, that drive you into the future and the past. When the hindrances decline, you start to feel calm and peaceful as a consequence. And this is the placidity that you see here. And so sometimes you have to narrow down your focus very narrowly. There's only a very tiny little good quality in that person, right? There isn't that much. But there's a little bit there, and you focus on that tiny little quality. So you have to be very careful not to look too far that way or that way, because then you see all the bad stuff. So you have to really keep your focus very sharp on this person. This is the point here. And the point that this can be done, right? This is the whole point. It sounds almost impossible, but the point is that it can be done. If you train yourself, if you train yourself to focus exclusively on the good qualities, it's possible to do that. And this is what is so good about this. Now, part of that, of course, a very helpful thing as well, and this is the thing we were talking about yesterday, is that it's very useful also to be able to forgive the negative qualities and to come to an understanding about the negative qualities. If you don't really know how to deal with those, it's very easy for them to intrude into your perception and stop your ability to focus on the good things. So for this reason, it's actually very good to try to understand the negative side in a person. Why are they like this? And there's always a reason why people have negative qualities. There's always a reason for that. There's always a conditioning in the past. There's always something in their upbringing, something at school, something at work, something from a past life even. There's always a reason for that. And when you understand that there is a reason, when you understand that the person themselves probably would have preferred not to have that bad quality, but they can't help themselves, right? Then you can actually move away and you can have compassion and understanding instead of getting upset. This is how you can forgive the negative side and at the same time rejoice, in a sense, in the good side and say, wow, even though they had all this bad conditioning from the past, still they have some good qualities. Wow, isn't that astonishing? And then you kind of turn the whole thing around and you see the goodness instead. So this is what we're doing here. We're focusing on this aspect. This person has this little bit of goodness left. This is the peace of the mind. How do you know that somebody else has peace of mind? Well, usually you can tell, right? We know each other. After a while, when you know somebody well, you know also their mental content. How do you know if somebody's angry? Well, you watch them, and they do strange, you know, they can just tell on the facial expression whether somebody is angry or not sometimes. So there's a lot of clues just by looking on somebody. You can actually pretty much read their minds. If you have a sharp ability to watch people, you can read their minds from that itself. It's interesting, the suttas often talk about reading the minds, right? This is something that occurs occasionally, at least in the suttas. And the Buddha says, well, the first way to read the mind is just to watch somebody, and you can read their mind. That's the first way, right? So that isn't very... not very kind of not the way what you often think about as reading the mind, but that's what how the Buddha taught that. Anyway, so that is the person with a little bit of good qualities, and then we have now comes the really bad guy. Next one. Okay. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure? And who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind from time to time. Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, or even in the hell realm. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is where compassion comes in, right? So far we have focused on metta all the way through. When you focus on somebody's good qualities, that's what is meant by metta in the Pali. It's a friendliness when you see, you get a friendly association when you see the good qualities in somebody else. Now this is the first time when this sutta brings up compassion, because here you have no choice anymore. There is no scope for metta when everything you see is bad, right? You can't see the good qualities. So then you turn instead over to compassion instead. And here you can see, this is exactly what I was saying, or similar to what I was saying before, is the idea that when somebody has lots of bad qualities, it's for their own disadvantage, right? They will suffer as a consequence of that. It may affect you in a bad way, but it affects them much, much worse, much more severely than it ever affects you. Because it affects them so badly, you realize that. You realize here is somebody, they're practicing for their own suffering. Nobody wants to practice for their own suffering, and yet here is somebody who does that. They're moving towards tremendous suffering for themselves. So how do you react when somebody is doing things which are not in their own interest? Somebody is doing things which actually is against their own interest. They are basically deluded. They are stupid. They cannot see things in the right way. How can you not have compassion towards such a person? Right? They're blind, basically. And this is the beautiful thing about this, is that this idea that when somebody is a really bad person, you can still have compassion, because you can understand that they don't understand. They don't understand their own best interest. Just like the sick person, right? It's just like an ill person, somebody who is severely ill, who is about to... How do you feel when somebody is really ill? What is your reaction when somebody is very sick? It's not their fault, right? They're sick, it just happens to them. Do you get angry or do you get a sense of compassion with them? You feel a sense of compassion if they suffer really badly. This is kind of the natural human response. And in exactly the same way, just as you feel for a sick person, you should feel for somebody who is practicing, leading a very bad life, and it doesn't have any good qualities. I don't know, I find this very powerful and very useful. But one of the interesting things here, which also comes out of this, and that is that in the three first cases, there is a focus on metta, and only in the fourth case is there a focus on compassion. This is very similar to what you find when you see the suttas, when they talk about the so-called Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are called, often translated as the divine abidings in English. And these are like the higher states of mind that we try to attain, which are very positive states of mind. Metta, compassion, like sympathetic joy, and the kind of evenness of the mind, the four Brahma Viharas. But the interesting thing here is that they always come in the same sequence, right? Metta is always first, and then comes compassion. I'm not going to talk about the two other ones because we're getting a bit too far afield, but metta comes first, then comes compassion. And we see exactly the same thing here. Metta comes first, then compassion. So why is that? Why is it that metta comes first? Is there a reason for that? And one of the things that becomes very clear after you read the teachings of the Buddha a lot is that things are not random, right? It's not kind of a random set of factors just whacked together and kind of, you know, which kind of higgledy-piggledy stuff. It's not like that at all. It is very structured. The suttas of the Buddha are very structured. And sequences always have a meaning. There is a reason why things come in a certain sequence. It's not random. And there's a reason why metta comes first and compassion comes afterwards. It doesn't actually say anywhere, but I think the reason is fairly obvious. And that is that metta is a much safer thing to develop than compassion. Metta can never go wrong. If you see the good qualities of somebody else and you wish them well as a base, based on those good qualities, it is always going to be a positive experience afterwards. You're going to feel good about that. Metta can never really go wrong. You can't go far to feel far in the wrong direction with metta. But compassion can relatively easy start to go wrong. If you look at compassion, it's often thinking about the suffering of other people, right? This is a classic example here. You think about the suffering of somebody else. They get reborn in a bad destination or whatever. Or in this life, you have compassion. It is based, you have compassion for the sick. It is based a little bit on the suffering of that person. So compassion can, if it is not used wisely, lead to kind of depression almost, right? A bit of sadness perhaps, because you're seeing the negative side of humanity and you're seeing the suffering in the world. So compassion is actually more difficult to practice properly. Metta is more safe. And for that reason, I recommend you to always use metta as the primary thing in your meditation practice or in dealing with difficult people or whatever. Use metta first, because metta is more safe. And you can't really go wrong when you use metta. Sometimes you have to use a bit of compassion. Sometimes metta and compassion, they kind of, you can't really separate them all that well, right? They kind of goes a little bit together, which is fine. But remember that metta is probably safer and better to use in the long run than compassion. This comes out here as well. And I think that's an interesting and quite important point, because many people say that they have problems with compassion and it makes them sad and that sort of thing. So please keep that in mind. Okay, now we come to the last person. And the last person is as follows. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind and placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind and placidity of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So here is the person who has lots of good qualities, right? They speak well, their bodily behavior is good, they even get some samadhi and some peace of mind. There's so many good things to see in this person. And then we come along and we still get angry with them. That's basically what it's saying here, right? This is life, isn't it? This life is like that. Sometimes you get angry even with the most saintly people. And you read the suttas and you see people coming up to the Buddha and getting really, really angry with the Buddha. And the Buddha just, he doesn't really react very much. And this is the point, that this is part of the problem in life, is that sometimes the problem is not with the other person, the problem is with us, right? We get angry sometimes when actually there is no reason even for getting angry. But of course, in this case, it is relatively easy to do something about that. You just have to remind yourself that actually, in this case, I am probably being irrational. And it's okay to admit that we make mistakes, right? Everybody makes mistakes, and this is just life. And it's okay to admit that, and then move on. If we don't admit to making mistakes, we're not really going to grow in this teaching. So you look then at the good sides instead of this person, which are very easy to see, and then you use that, and you drink, again, you have this idea of the pond, right? The sweet, cool, beautiful pond. This time there are no algae, there's no water plants to push aside this time, because there are no algae there. All there is this beautiful, clear pond. And you lie down and you drink the water and you bathe in the pond, and afterwards you come out and you lie down in the shade of the various trees. So it's like you continue enjoying those good qualities of that person here. So this is the last person. Again, I think it's fairly easy to understand what is going on here. And at the very last sentence here, he says that, friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. And this is quite important. This is kind of the thing, the importance of having people in the world who still practice the Dhamma, right? Who still are examples of how the teachings actually work in practice. And for me, this is always one of the powerful things about the Buddha's teachings, that on the one hand, you have these ancient teachings that have been passed down for 2,500 years. They have been tried and tried again, and they have survived all that time. And when you read them, they are powerful and beautiful teachings. You have that on the one hand, and on the other hand, you still have people who practice these things and still attain the results of the path, right? So you have the living example, and you have the ancient teachings. It's a very, very beautiful combination. It means the living example gives you confidence that the teaching works. The fact that it is an ancient teaching means that those living examples, they can't really take credit for this, right? They're not some kind of crazy guru walking down the street and saying, I'm enlightened or whatever, follow me. They're saying, I'm following this ancient path. I too am a disciple of the Buddha. So it leads to less of this kind of ego maniac kind of situation where people do things just because it's more to do with a sense of self than to do with a spiritual life and all that. So this is a beautiful combination, the ancient teaching together with a living example. I find it very powerful. And so it is important for us sometimes to get that feeling that you are in the presence of someone, a teacher, whether it's a monk or a nun or even a lay person, it doesn't matter who it is, who you feel have actually understood this and seen these things. They have special qualities, right? And in the suttas, there is a nice place where the Buddha says that even seeing an arahant is a fully awakened person, even just seeing an arahant in the world is a great blessing for other people. Because when you see an arahant, when you see somebody who has no defilements, who has lots of metta and compassion and peace and time and understanding and wisdom, who has all these beautiful qualities, when you see that, you understand just by the seeing that, wow, there is something more in this world, there's something extra, something which ordinary people don't have, actually exists, it's possible, right? You understand that there's something higher, something kind of above the ordinary human condition. And it gives you a sense of hope, a sense of feeling that there's something more to live for than the ordinary, mundane things of ordinary life. So just seeing an arahant gives you a sense of, wow, there is something in this world. And it's not just empty hope, like, you know, hope which is just empty. It's hope that is based on something real and tangible. And that is why it is so powerful. So that is important. It's important to have both sides of the story. And I have, myself, I feel that I have seen a number of people, maybe not that many, but certainly a few people in my life. When I look at them, I think, wow, these people have qualities which are not usually found in the human, in the human world. They have lifted themselves up a little bit out of the human world, and they are on a different level from the rest of us. That is very, very inspiring and very powerful. And that is the best way of using those inspiring examples, is not to get too angry with them, but to see them as examples instead. And then things become very useful. That is how to remove anger in life. This is one way of doing it. There are many other ways as well of removing anger. I won't get into those now because it's getting a bit late, but maybe we can talk about those later on if you want in the Q&A session afterwards. And I'll just read out the very last sutta here. This is just a sutta. This is just the Buddha inspiring his monks and nuns, inspiring his disciples to practice. This is what this last sutta is about. It's called the Gotamaka Sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali at the Gotamaka shrine. There the Blessed One, the Buddha, addressed the monks. Monks, I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. I teach the Dhamma with a basis, not without a basis. I teach the Dhamma that is wonderful or convincing, if you like, not one that is not. Since I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge, since I teach the Dhamma with a basis, not without a basis, since I teach a Dhamma that is wonderful, one not one that is not, my teaching should be acted upon, my instruction should be acted upon. It is not enough for you to rejoice, enough for you to be elated, enough for you to be joyful. The Blessed One is perfectly awakened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good path. So that is the Buddha just basically saying that this works. That's what he's saying here. This is it, right? This works. It does take you to awakening. It does take you to happiness. It does take you to profound states of meditation. I'm telling you because I know, right? This is direct knowledge. I understand this. I'm telling you because wonderful here. I teach the Dhamma that is wonderful means it is a. It actually works. This is the wonder in Buddhism, is the idea that the path actually works. You can't practice this and you will get results. And because of that, there's every reason to be joyful, right? You'll be happy. Here you have these marvelous teachings, this wonderful thing that brings us happiness and brings you joy and takes you away from suffering and problems. And isn't that a kind of a message which is very, very hopeful and beautiful? And you can, of course, experience these things right here, right now. Starting with a meditation, which is going to begin in about 1 minute. Okay, so let us, I think that's enough for now. So please enjoy the next meditation and then we will continue as we did yesterday.